is how. Like Joe Casper, who could not save his son Ryan, Jeff knows he couldn't save the one he loved most. But he hopes that earlier cancer detection will save millions of lives within the next decade. He says that he now gets out of bed every morning faster and with more energy than he ever has in his life. Jeff has found meaning through the fifth kind of post-traumatic growth, seeing new possibilities. Tedeschi and Calhoun found that after trauma, some people ended up choosing different directions for their lives that they never would have considered before. In the wake of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, some Americans made dramatic changes in their careers. They joined fire departments, enlisted in the military, and entered the medical professions. Applications to Teach for America tripled, and many of the aspiring teachers said their interest stemmed from 9/11. Those seeking a change wanted to use their precious time to contribute to something larger than themselves. Before the attacks, work might have been a job. Afterward, some wanted a calling. People were also more likely to find meaning after surviving a tornado, a mass shooting, or a plane crash if they believed they were going to die during the event. After being reminded of their mortality, survivors often re-examine their priorities, which in some cases results in growth. A brush with death can lead to a new life. It's not an easy pivot. Trauma often makes it harder to pursue new possibilities. Caring for loved ones who are sick can mean that family members have to work less or stop working altogether. Almost 3 million Americans are caring for an adult with cancer, which takes an average of 33 hours a week. Along with the loss of income, high medical costs frequently decimate family budgets. Illness is a factor in more than 40% of bankruptcies, and there's evidence that people with cancer are more than 2.5 times more likely to file for bankruptcy. Even relatively small, unexpected expenses can have disastrous consequences. 46% of Americans are unable to pay an emergency bill of $400. For people living on the edge, paid family leave, quality health care, and mental health coverage can make the difference between hanging on and falling off. Tragedy does more than rip away our present. It also tears apart our hopes for our future. Accidents shatter people's dreams of being able to support their families. Severe illnesses prevent people from finding work or love. Divorce erases future anniversaries. Although I have a friend who celebrates her breakup each year. These profound shifts in self-perception are another secondary loss and a risk factor for depression. Our possible selves, who we hoped to become, can be collateral damage. Although it can be extremely difficult to grasp, the disappearance of one possible self can free us to imagine a new possible self. After tragedy, we sometimes miss these opportunities because we spend all of our emotional energy wishing for our old lives. As Helen Keller put it, when one door of happiness closes, another opens. But often we look so long at the closed door that we do not see the one which has been opened for us. For Joe Casper, the breakthrough occurred when he realized that his actions could be part of his son's legacy. While studying for his master's degree, Joe created a therapeutic process called Co-Destiny, which encourages bereaved parents to view their child's life in a larger framework so that death does not become the end of the story. Parents who seek purpose and meaning from their tragedies can go on to do good, which then becomes part of their child's impact on the world. As Joe explained, I realized that my destiny was to live my life in a way that would make my son proud. The awareness that I could add goodness to my son's life by doing good in his name motivates me to this day. It's not surprising that so many trauma survivors end up helping others overcome the adversity that they have faced themselves. There is nothing more gratifying than helping someone else escape this quagmire of despair, Joe told us. I know this passion of mine is an area of personal growth related to my trauma. helping others grow from their traumas reflects back to my son's life. After undergoing a hardship, people have new knowledge to offer those who go through similar experiences. It is a unique source of meaning because it does not just give our lives purpose. It gives our suffering purpose. People help where they've been hurt so that their wounds are not in vain. While we are grieving, it can be hard to see through the pain to new possibilities or greater meaning. When my mom left to go home after staying with me for the first month, I was terrified. As she hugged me goodbye, she told me about a conversation she'd had with Scott Pearson, a family friend. The week Dave died, Scott said, "This is the end of one chapter and the beginning of the next. I didn't tell you then because I didn't think you would have believed him. But I have believed it all along. And so should you." I am not sure I could have heard this a month earlier, but on that day, it gave me hope. To quote the Roman philosopher Seneca and the song Closing Time, "Every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end." A few years ago, Dave and I took our children to see the play Wicked. On the way out, one of us shouted enthusiastically, "That's my favorite musical!" You might guess it was our preteen daughter, but it wasn't. It was Dave. His favorite song was For Good, when the two lead characters say goodbye and acknowledge that they may never see each other again. Together they sing, "I do believe I have been changed for the better. And because I knew you, I have been changed for good." Dave will always be, as the song says, a handprint on my heart. He changed me in profound ways by his presence, and he changed me in profound ways by his absence. It's my deepest desire that something good will come from the horror of Dave's death. When people say they have found comfort or strength in what I've shared, it honors the life Dave lived. He did so much to help others, and I hope this book reaches people and becomes part of his legacy. Perhaps this is our co-destiny. Chapter 6, Taking Back Joy. The first week of middle school, my best friend informed me that I wasn't cool enough to hang out with. This hurtful breakup turned out to be a blessing. Soon after I was dumped, three girls picked me up. We became friends for life, adding three more to our circle in high school. Mindy, Eve, Jamie, Elise, Pam, and Beth, or as we call ourselves, the girls. The girls have advised me on everything from what to wear to prom, to what job to take, to what to do when a baby wakes up at midnight. And again at 3 a.m. In the fall of 2015, Beth's daughter was becoming a bat mitzvah. Part of me didn't want to go. Just days before he died, Dave and I had picked a date for our son's bar mitzvah. The thought that Dave would not be at our child's ceremonial transition to adulthood cast a giant pall over the occasion. But during the dark days of that summer, the girls had checked in daily and took turns coming to California. By showing up again and again, they proved to me that I was not alone. I wanted to be there for them in the happy times, just as they'd been there for me in the sad. Sitting with the girls and their families at the bat mitzvah service felt deeply comforting, almost as if I had been transported back to when we were teenagers, to the innocent days when a bad haircut was a big problem. Beth's daughter crushed the Torah reading, and we all teared up with pride. The ceremony ended with the traditional reciting of the Kaddish, the prayer for those who have died. Instantly, six hands reached out to me from in front, in back, and across the pew. My friends held me tightly and, as they had promised, we got through it together. At the party that night, our kids ran around having a great time. I watched my son and daughter chatting away with their almost cousins and thought there should be a word for the joy you feel when your kids are friends with your friends' kids. In addition to the girls, there were other guests from our Miami school days, including the cutest boy in our class, Brooke Rose. Even his name is perfect. Back then, none of us believed we had a chance with him. And after college, he confirmed that when he told us he's gay. The DJ started playing September by Earth, Wind, and Fire, and Brooke reached for my hand. Come on, he said, flashing his gorgeous smile. He led me to the dance floor, and just like in high school, we let go, dancing and singing, and then I burst into tears. Brooke quickly maneuvered me to the outdoor patio and asked what was wrong. At first, I assumed I was missing Dave, except I knew exactly what that felt like, and somehow this was different. Then it dawned on me. Dancing to an upbeat song from childhood had taken me to a place where I wasn't filled with loneliness and longing. I wasn't just feeling okay. I actually felt happy. And that happiness was followed immediately by a flood of guilt. How could I be happy when Dave was gone? The next day, my kids and I headed to Philadelphia to visit Adam and his family. I told Adam about my meltdown on the dance floor. He wasn't surprised. Of course this was the first moment you were happy, he told me. You haven't been doing a single thing that brings you joy. Adam was right. For more than 4 months, I'd been completely focused on my kids, my job, and just making it through each day. I had stopped doing anything Dave and I had done together for fun, like seeing movies, going out to dinner with friends, watching Game of Thrones, or playing Settlers of Catan or Scrabble. Catan was especially upsetting to me since we'd been playing during our last moments together. There were plenty of reasons to hole up. I didn't want to leave my kids with a babysitter even after they fell asleep in case they woke up. I was afraid that if I tried to go out, I'd end up crying in public, embarrassing myself and ruining everyone else's good time. I had made one attempt to be social early that fall. I invited a small group of friends over to watch a movie. We started the evening with frozen yogurt in the kitchen, and I kept thinking, "You can do this. Pretend everything's normal." The movie had been recommended by a friend as fun and light. We started watching. So far, so good. Then a few minutes in, the main character's wife died. I thought the froyo was going to come back up. Everything was not normal. In my Facebook post 30 days into widowhood, I wrote that I'd never have another moment of pure joy. When friends who had lost spouses assured me that this wasn't true and someday I would feel happy again, I doubted them. Then Earth, Wind, and Fire proved me wrong. But the moment of happiness on the dance floor was fleeting, barely rearing its head before guilt whacked it back into its hole. Survivor guilt is a thief of joy, yet another secondary loss from death. When people lose a loved one, they are not just racked with grief, but also with remorse. It's another personalization trap. Why am I the one who is still alive? Even after acute grief is gone, the guilt remains. I didn't spend enough time with him. And death isn't the only kind of loss that triggers guilt. When a company lays off employees, those who keep their jobs often struggle with survivor guilt. The thought process begins with, "It should have been me." This is followed by gratitude, "I'm glad it wasn't me," which is quickly washed away by shame. "I'm a bad person for feeling happy when my friends lost their jobs." A life chasing pleasure without meaning is an aimless existence. Yet a meaningful life without joy is a depressing one. Until that moment on the dance floor, I did not realize I'd been holding myself back from happiness. And even that fleeting moment was ruined by guilt, making my prediction that I'd never feel pure joy again seem accurate. Then one day on the phone, Dave's brother Rob gave me a true gift. "Since the day Dave met you, all he ever wanted was to make you happy," Rob told me, his voice choking up. "He would want you to be happy. Even now, don't take that away from him." My sister-in-law Amy helped too by making me see how much my mood affected my children. They had told her they were feeling better because Mommy stopped crying all the time. When we focus on others, we find motivation that is difficult to marshal for ourselves alone. In 2015, U.S. Army Major Lisa Jaster was attempting to graduate from the elite Ranger School. Having served in Afghanistan and Iraq, she thought she could complete the grueling program in 9 weeks. But getting through land navigation, water survival, staged assaults, ambushes, mountaineering, and an obstacle course took her 26 weeks. The final event was a 12-mile march carrying a 35-pound rucksack plus 9 quarts of water and a rifle. By the 10-mile mark, Lisa felt nauseous. Her feet were blistered, and she thought there was no way she could make it to the finish line. But then an image flashed through her mind. A cherished picture of her and her kids. Her son had Batman on his t-shirt, and her daughter had Wonder Woman on hers. On the photo, Lisa had written, "I want to be their superhero." Lisa ran the last 2 miles and beat her target time by a minute and a half. She went on to make history as one of the first 3 women to become an Army Ranger. When I met Lisa, I told her she wasn't just her kids' superhero. I shared her story at the dinner table, and now she's a hero to my kids, too. With Rob's and Amy's words ringing in my ears, I decided to try having fun for my children and with my children. Dave had loved playing Catan with our kids because it taught them to think ahead and anticipate opponents' moves. One afternoon, I took the game down from the shelf. I asked my kids matter-of-factly if they wanted to play. They did. In the past, I was always orange. My daughter was blue. My son was red. Dave was gray. When just the 3 of us sat down to play, my daughter pulled out the gray pieces. My son got upset and tried to take them away from her, insisting, "That was Daddy's color. You can't be gray." I held his hand and said, "She can be gray. We take things back." "We take it back" became our mantra. Rather than give up the things that reminded us of Dave, we embraced them and made them an ongoing part of our lives. We took back rooting for the teams that Dave loved, the Minnesota Vikings and the Golden State Warriors. We took back poker, which Dave had played with our kids since they were young. They laughed at the story about how one day Dave came home from work to find them playing poker at ages 5 and 7, and said it was one of the proudest moments of his life. Chamath Palihapitiya, our friend who had played poker with Dave frequently and enthusiastically, stepped in to continue their Texas Hold'em education. "I would have tried, but I don't think Dave would have wanted them to learn from a lousy player," Dave's words, but boy did Chamath agree frequently and enthusiastically. For myself, I took back Game of Thrones. It wasn't nearly as much fun as watching with Dave, who had read the entire series of books and could track who was plotting against whom. But I focused, caught up, and ended the season rooting for Khaleesi and her dragons, just as Dave and I would have together. I started having friends over to watch movies, looking more carefully for ones where no one loses a spouse. And my best take back was finding the perfect online Scrabble opponent. Dave and I had played together. Dave and Rob had played together. Now Rob and I play each other. I am a poor substitute since the 2 brothers were evenly matched. In almost 100 games, I've beaten Rob a grand total of once. But now, for just a few minutes on our phones throughout the day, Rob and I are connected to each other. And to Dave. We want others to be happy. Allowing ourselves to be happy, accepting that it is okay to push through the guilt and seek joy, is a triumph over permanence. Having fun is a form of self-compassion. Just as we need to be kind to ourselves when we make mistakes, we also need to be kind to ourselves by enjoying life when we can. Tragedy breaks down your door and takes you prisoner. To escape takes effort and energy. Seeking joy after facing adversity is taking back what was stolen from you. As U2 lead singer Bono has said, joy is the ultimate act of defiance. One of the comments on my 30-day Facebook post that affected me most deeply was from a woman named Virginia Schimpf Nacy. Virginia was happily married when her husband died suddenly in his sleep at age 53. 6.5 years later, the night before her daughter's wedding, Virginia's son died of a heroin overdose. She insisted on going forward with the wedding and planned her son's funeral the next day. Soon, Virginia was working with her local school district on a drug prevention program, joining forces with parents and counselors to create a grief support group, and advocating for legislative changes to fight addiction. She also looked for ways to counter her sadness. She started watching old Carol Burnett shows and went on a cross-country road trip with her chocolate Labrador to visit her daughter and son-in-law. Both deaths are woven into the fabric of my life, but they're not what define me, she said. Joy is very important to me, and I can't count on joy to come from my daughter or anyone else. It has to come from me. It is time to kick the shit out of option C. When we look for joy, we often focus on the big moments. Graduating from school, having a child, getting a job, being reunited with family. But happiness is the frequency of positive experiences, not the intensity. In a 12-year study of bereaved spouses in Australia, 26% managed to find joy after loss as often as they had before. What set them apart was that they re-engaged in everyday activities and interactions. How we spend our days, author Annie Dillard writes, is how we spend our lives. Rather than waiting until we're happy to enjoy the small things, we should go and do the small things that make us happy. After a depressing divorce, a friend of mine made a list of things she enjoyed: listening to musicals, seeing her nieces and nephews, looking at art books, eating flan, and made a vow to do one thing on the list after work each day. As blogger Tim Urban describes it, happiness is the joy you find on hundreds of forgettable Wednesdays. My New Year's resolution for 2016 was based on this idea. Each night, I was still trying to write down 3 things I had done well, but as my confidence returned, this seemed less necessary. Then Adam suggested a new idea. Write down 3 moments of joy every day. Of all the New Year's resolutions I've ever made, this is the one I've kept the longest by far. Now nearly every night before I go to sleep, I jot down 3 happy moments in my notebook. Doing this makes me notice and appreciate these flashes of joy. When something positive happens, I think, this will make the notebook. It's a habit that brightens the whole day. Many years ago, a mentor of mine, Larry Brilliant, tried to teach me that happiness requires work. Larry and I had grown close while starting Google's philanthropic initiative, so I was heartbroken when his son John was diagnosed with lung cancer at age 24. John was treated at Stanford and often spent nights at our house since we lived closer to the hospital. He brought his treasured childhood Lego sets to play with my kids, and to this day, when my kids play with Legos, I think of John. For a few months, it looked like John had made a miraculous recovery, so when he died 1.5 years later, his family was doubly shattered. Larry's deep spirituality helped build his resilience. For 10 years, Larry and his wife Girja had lived in India, where they studied with a Hindu guru and practiced Buddhist meditation. After losing their son, they focused their spiritual work on turning some of the pain into gratitude for the years when John was healthy. At Dave's funeral, Larry sobbed with me, saying that he never expected us to be grieving for another loved one so soon. Then, with his hands on my shoulders, as if to hold me up, he said he'd be there to make sure the pain didn't drown me. A day of joy is 15 minutes. A day of pain is 15 years, he said. No one pretends this is easy, but the job of life is to make those 15 minutes into 15 years, and those 15 years into 15 minutes. Paying attention to moments of joy takes effort, because we are wired to focus on the negatives more than the positives. Bad events tend to have a stronger effect on us than good events. This made sense in prehistoric times. If you weren't haunted by the memory of the time someone you loved ate the poisonous berries, you might nibble on them yourself. But today, we give that attention to ordinary setbacks and daily hassles. A broken windshield wiper or a coffee stain has the power to drag us down. We zero in on potential threats and miss opportunities to smile. Just as labeling negative emotions can help us process them, labeling positive emotions works too. Writing about joyful experiences for just 3 days can improve people's moods and decrease their visits to health centers a full 3 months later. We can savor the smallest of daily events. How good a warm breeze feels, or how delicious French fries taste, especially when snatched from someone else's plate. My mom is one of the most optimistic people I know, and when she gets in bed each night, she always spends a few moments being grateful for the comfort of the pillow under her head. As we get older, we define happiness less in terms of excitement and more in terms of peacefulness. Reverend Veronica Goines sums this up as, "Peace is joy at rest, and joy is peace on its feet." Sharing positive events with another person also increases our own pleasant emotions over the next few days. In the words of Shannon Sedgwick Davis, a human rights advocate whose work requires her to deal with atrocities on a daily basis, "Joy is a discipline." A friend of mine who lost his wife of 48 years right after his 70th birthday told me that to fight despair, he needed to shake up his routine. Doing the same things he'd done with his wife left him yearning for his old life, so he made a concerted effort to seek out new activities. He advised me to do the same. Along with taking things back, I looked for ways to move forward. I started small. My kids and I began playing Hearts, a card game my grandfather taught me, and one I'm better at than poker. We began biking on weekends, which Dave couldn't do because it hurt his back. I started playing the piano again, something I hadn't done in 30 years. I play badly due to a lack of talent compounded by a lack of practice. Still, plinking out a song makes me feel better. It gives me a smile, to paraphrase a Billy Joel song I play badly and sing off-key, to forget about life for a while. Playing music at the edge of our capabilities is what psychologists call a just manageable difficulty. This level requires all of our attention, giving us no room to think about anything else. Many of us remember being happiest in flow, the state of total absorption in a task. When you're in a deep conversation with a friend and suddenly realize that 2 hours have flown by. When you take a road trip and the dashed line becomes a rhythm. When you're engrossed in reading a Harry Potter book and forget Hogwarts isn't real. Total muggle mistake. But there's a catch. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who pioneered this research, found that people don't report being happy while they are in flow. They are so engaged that they only describe it as joyful afterward. Even trying to survey people about their flow states jolted them right out of it. Good work, psychologists. Many turn to exercise for flow. After losing his wife, comedian Patton Oswalt noticed that comic books like Batman portrayed strange reactions to grief. In real life, if Bruce Wayne watched his parents murdered at 9, he wouldn't become this buff hero, Oswalt said. How about someone dies and they just get fat and angry and confused? But no, immediately they're at the gym. Actually, hitting the gym, or just the pavement for a brisk walk, can be hugely beneficial. The physical health effects of exercise are well known, including lower risk of heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, diabetes, and arthritis. Many doctors and therapists also point to exercise as one of the best ways to improve psychological well-being. For some adults over 50 who suffer from major depression, Working out may even be as effective as taking an antidepressant. Flow might sound like a luxury, but after tragedy, it can become essential. 4 years ago in Syria, Wafe, last name not included to protect her family's security, fell into despair when her husband was arrested. He has not been seen or heard from since. Just a few months before that, her 16-year-old son was killed while playing soccer outside their apartment. Wafe couldn't bear the pain and considered taking her own life, but she was pregnant with her sixth child and that stopped her. She and her brother fled to Istanbul with her two youngest children, while her three older children stayed behind in Syria. Not long after, she received a call from her daughter, who had a son of her own. He had just been killed by a sniper a week before his second birthday. Beyond unimaginable. Unfathomable. Wafe's experience is horrifyingly common. There are more refugees today than there have been at any time since World War II. More than 65 million people have had their lives viciously torn apart. If option B for me means coping with the loss of a spouse, option B for refugees means coping with loss upon loss upon loss. Loss of loved ones, home, country, and all that is familiar. When I read Wafe's story, I was struck by her incredible resilience and got in touch to learn more. She opened up about her struggles. "When my son was murdered, I thought I would die," she told us through a translator. "Being a mother saved me. I need to smile for my other children." When Wafe arrived in Turkey, she spent most days alone with her children while her brother tried to find work. She did not speak the language, knew almost no one, and felt overwhelmingly lonely. Then she found a community center for Syrians and met other women who were also struggling. Little by little, Wafe found moments of joy. "Praying makes me happy," she said. "My relationship with God is stronger. I understand him more, and I know he will keep giving me strength." Along with prayer, she finds comfort and flow in making meals for her family and friends. "Some days, time moves slowly and I think too much. Cooking gives me something to look forward to. Cooking is like breathing in Syria. It gives me oxygen. I'm not a painter, but I love creating. The smells, the feel of the meat. No matter where I am, I can try to recreate home. Cooking gives me comfort and helps me focus. Sometimes I lose myself in the cooking. Then the time goes quickly. My mind goes quiet." When one of Wafe's neighbors in Istanbul became sick, Wafe made her food every day for a week. "It filled me with happiness to think I could help her with food, and Syrian food. It was my way to say, 'Take this from my homeland. I have nothing else to give.'" Caring for her children and others is a source of joy for Wafe. As she told us, "When my children smile, I feel happiness. I feel that I am still here for a reason. I will be healed through healing them." Whether you see joy as a discipline, an act of defiance, a luxury, or a necessity, it is something everyone deserves. Joy allows us to go on living and loving and being there for others. Even when we're in great distress, joy can still be found in moments we seize and moments we create. Cooking, dancing, hiking, praying, driving, singing Billy Joel songs off key. All of these can provide relief from pain. And when these moments add up, we find that they give us more than happiness. They also give us strength. Chapter 7. Raising Resilient Kids. There is an exquisitely detailed painting of two children from South Carolina by award-winning painter Timothy Chambers. Tim has been a professional artist for more than 30 years, vividly capturing portraits and landscapes in oil, charcoal, and pastel. He is 70% deaf. He is also legally blind. If you're sitting for a portrait and Tim looks you in the eye, he cannot see your mouth. Instead of taking in the whole scene, he scans his subject bit by bit, memorizing as many details as he can. Then he fills in from memory what his eyes leave out. A good painting is a lot of good decisions, he explains. The symptoms of Tim's genetic condition, Usher syndrome, appeared early. At 5, Tim was wearing hearing aids full-time. By high school, when he was walking around at night, a friend would say, "Duck," so he didn't run into tree branches. Finally, when Tim turned 30, an eye doctor referred him to a specialist who diagnosed his condition. He also informed Tim there was no cure. The doctor's recommendation was blunt. "You'd better find another profession." After this discouraging advice, Tim struggled with sometimes paralyzing fear and frequent nightmares. Once, after he spent 2 hours finishing a charcoal portrait, his son walked in and asked, "What's with the purple?" Tim could no longer see the difference between purple and gray. Searching for other ways to use his knowledge, he began teaching art classes online. He received glowing reviews, and students halfway around the world started waking up at 2 a.m. to learn from him. Tim and his wife, Kim, expanded these classes into an online school. One day, Kim watched a talk Adam gave on resilience and felt like he was describing her husband. She emailed Adam to explain that Tim was the most persevering person I have ever had the privilege to know. Adam wondered where Tim got his resilience. Tim said it began with his parents. Tim's dad had a knack for reframing painful events. One day, Tim came home from school upset that kids were staring and asking what was in his ear. His father gave him a tip. Next time it happened, Tim could press his hearing aid, throw a punch in the air, and shout, "Yes! Cubs are up 2-1 in the ninth!" Tim gave it a try, and the kids were jealous that he was listening to the game during a boring class. In high school, Tim leaned in for a kiss at the end of a date, and his hearing aid started beeping loudly. His father told him not to worry about it. "She's probably saying to her mom right now, 'I kissed boys before tonight, and I've seen fireworks, but I've never heard sirens.'" Tim followed his dad's advice and learned to respond to embarrassment with humor. He discovered that his own reaction to his disability influenced how others reacted, which meant he could control how he was perceived. Reframing these moments became second nature. It was a blessing to have a dad who turned times when you're feeling stupid into, "You become stronger as you seek solutions to seeming roadblocks or dead ends," he said. "When Dave died, my biggest concern was that my children's happiness would be destroyed. My childhood friend Mindy Levy lost her mother to suicide when we were 13. I slept in Mindy's room that night and held her as she cried. More than 30 years later, she was the first friend I called from the hospital in Mexico. I screamed into the phone hysterically, 'Tell me my kids are going to be okay. Tell me they'll be okay.' At first, Mindy couldn't figure out what had happened. Once she did, she told me what she truly believed. My children would be okay. In that moment, nothing could have consoled me, but I knew Mindy grew up to be a loving and happy adult. Having seen her recover helped me believe that my daughter and son could too. After the flight home, hours I can barely remember, my mom and sister met me at the airport, tears streaming down their faces, their bodies supporting me as I got into the car. My worst nightmare had never included the conversation I was about to have. How do you tell a 7- and 10-year-old that they will never see their father again? On the way back from Mexico, Marnie had reminded me that a close friend of ours, Carol Geithner, was a social worker who counseled grieving children. I called Carol on the agonizing car ride home. She suggested that I first let my kids know that I had very sad news, and then tell them what had happened simply and directly. She said it was important to reassure them that many parts of their lives would be just like before. They still had the rest of their family. They would still go to school with their friends. She told me to follow their lead and answer their questions, and that they might ask if I was going to die too. I was grateful she had prepared me for this since it was one of my daughter's first questions. Carol advised me not to make a false promise to them that I would live forever, but rather explain to them that it was very unusual for someone to die so young. Mostly, she told me to say over and over that I loved them, and we would get through this together. When I walked in the house, my daughter greeted me as if nothing was out of the ordinary. "Hi, Mom," she said, and headed upstairs to her room. I was frozen to the floor. My son immediately realized something was wrong. "Why are you home?" he asked. "And where's Dad?" We all sat down on the couch with my parents and my sister. My heart was pounding so loudly that I could barely hear my own voice. With my father's strong arm around my shoulders, trying to protect me as he always has, I found the courage to speak. "I have terrible news. Terrible. Daddy died." The screaming and crying that followed haunt me to this day. Primal screams and cries that echoed the ones in my heart. Nothing has come close to the pain of this moment. Even now, when my mind wanders back, I shake and my throat constricts. Still, as truly horrific as this was, we got through it. I would never wish for anyone to gain this perspective. But perspective it is. While they suffered an irreparable loss, my children are still fortunate. Nothing will bring their father back, but our circumstances have softened the blow. This is not the case for many children facing heartbreaking difficulties. 2 out of 10 U.S. children of all backgrounds live in poverty, and 1/3 of Black and close to 1/3 of Latino children are poor. 43% of children of single mothers live in poverty. More than 2.5 million children have a parent in jail. Many children face serious illness, neglect, abuse, or homelessness. These extreme levels of harm and deprivation can impede children's intellectual, social, emotional, and academic development. We owe all children safety, support, opportunity, and help finding a way forward, especially in the most tragic situations. Early and comprehensive intervention is critical. At trauma-sensitive schools, like the primary school in East Palo Alto, the staff is trained to recognize the effects of toxic stress on children. When kids misbehave, instead of being blamed, shamed, or severely punished, they are made to feel safe so that they can learn. These schools also offer mental health and crisis support services for children and coaching for their parents. High-quality preschool education is known to improve children's cognitive development, and providing support even earlier makes a difference. All around the United States, the Nurse Family Partnership has proven through rigorous experiments how valuable investing in children can be. When disadvantaged families are provided with home visits and counseling from the start of pregnancy until the kids turn 2, over the next decade and a half, there are 79% fewer cases of child abuse and neglect. By the time these children turn 15, on average, they are arrested half as often as their peers. And their mothers receive cash assistance benefits for 30 fewer months. Programs like this help build resilience within families. Along with being the correct moral choice, these investments make economic sense too. Every dollar put into these visits yields about $5.70 in benefits. We all want to raise resilient kids so they can overcome obstacles big and small. Resilience leads to greater happiness, more success, and better health. As I learned from Adam, and as Tim's dad knew instinctively, resilience is not a fixed personality trait. It's a lifelong project. Building resilience depends on the opportunities children have and the relationships they form with parents, caregivers, teachers, and friends. We can start by helping children develop four core beliefs. 1. They have some control over their lives. 2. They can learn from failure. 3. They matter as human beings. And 4. They have real strengths to rely on and share. These four beliefs have a real impact on kids. One study tracked hundreds of at-risk children for 3 decades. They grew up in environments with severe poverty, alcohol abuse, or mental illness, and 2 out of 3 developed serious problems by adolescence and adulthood. Yet despite these extreme hardships, 1/3 of the kids matured into competent, confident, and caring young adults, with no record of delinquency or mental health problems. These resilient children shared something. They felt a strong sense of control over their lives. They saw themselves as the masters of their own fate and viewed negative events not as threats, but as challenges and even opportunities. The same holds true for children who aren't at risk. The most resilient ones realize they have the power to shape their own lives. Their caregivers communicate clear and consistent expectations, giving them structure and predictability, which increases their sense of control. Kathy Anderson showed me how powerful control can be. I first met Kathy through her heroic efforts to rescue teenage victims of sex trafficking and exploitation in Miami. Kathy created a program called Change Your Shoes that helps young women see that the trauma in their past does not determine their future. They feel they have limited choices, Kathy says. Like me, most of them have been abused, and that abuse makes you feel like you have no control over your own life. My goal is to show them that they have the power to step out of their shoes, step out of everything that holds them back. They can take little steps every day to make their lives better. I try to inspire them to put on the shoes they want to walk in and know that they still have choices to make. I joined Kathy at a group meeting in the living room of a drop-in center, where I met Johanna Cheka J. Francois, a 15-year-old mother who was holding her new baby on her lap. Jay described the horrors of being abused at home, running away, and becoming a victim of sex trafficking. I saw how Kathy responded, sharing her own story, how she had been abused by her adoptive father, run away from home, and survived a suicide attempt. Kathy told the girls that her life turned around once she realized that her only way out was to get an education. Kathy asked the girls to share their dreams. One said she wanted to be an artist. Another said she wanted to be a lawyer to help girls like her. 1/3 wanted to run a nonprofit to provide shelter to girls in need. Jay said that her dream was to be a great mother. Kathy then asked the girls to write down the goals that would allow them to achieve those dreams. All of them wrote down the same thing. They would need to finish school. Next, Kathy asked them to share what they would have to do today, and the next day, and the next day, to reach that goal. Get better grades, one said. Find a high school to go to and register, said another. Commit to study, said Jay. Since then, Jay has defied the odds by finishing high school and starting college. I feel like now my future is in my hands, she says. It's all about being a great mother for my daughter and giving her a good future. The second belief that shapes children's resilience is that they can learn from failure. Psychologist Carol Dweck has shown that children respond better to adversity when they have a growth mindset instead of a fixed one. A fixed mindset means viewing abilities as something we're either born with or not. I'm a whiz at math, but don't have the drama gene. When kids have a growth mindset, they see abilities as skills that can be learned and developed. They can work to improve. I may not be a natural actor, but if I rehearse enough, I can shine on the stage. Whether children develop a fixed or growth mindset depends in part on the type of praise they receive from parents and teachers. Dweck's team randomly assigned students to receive different kinds of positive feedback after they took a test. The kids who were praised for being smart did worse on later tests because they viewed their intelligence as a fixed attribute. When the smart ones struggled, they decided that they just didn't have the ability. Instead of attempting to complete a more difficult test, they gave up. But when kids were praised for trying, they worked harder on the challenging test and made more of an effort to finish it. Dweck and her collaborators have shown that growth mindsets can be taught relatively quickly and with remarkable effects. After students at risk of dropping out of high school completed an online exercise emphasizing that skills can be developed, their academic performance improved. When college freshmen completed this same exercise during orientation, the dropout risk among Black, Latino, and first-generation students decreased by 46%. Their academic struggles seemed less personal and permanent, and the students became as likely to stay in school as those from other backgrounds. When coupled with high-quality education and long-term support, programs like this can have a lasting impact. Today, the importance of helping kids develop a growth mindset is widely recognized, but poorly practiced. There's a knowing-doing gap. Many parents and teachers understand the idea, but do not always succeed in applying it. Despite my best efforts, I am sometimes one of those parents. When my daughter does well on a test, I still find myself blurting out, "Great job!" rather than, "I'm glad you tried your hardest." In How to Raise an Adult, former Stanford Dean Julie Lithcott-Hames advises parents to teach children that difficulties are how we grow. She calls this normalizing struggle. When parents treat failure as an opportunity to learn rather than an embarrassment to be avoided, kids are more likely to take on challenges. When a kid struggles at math, instead of saying, "Maybe math isn't one of your strengths," Dweck recommends, "The feeling of math being hard is the feeling of your brain growing." The third belief that affects children's resilience is mattering. Knowing that other people notice you, care about you, and rely on you. Many parents communicate this naturally. They listen closely to their children, show that they value their ideas, and help them create strong, secure attachments with others. In a study of more than 2,000 adolescents between the ages of 11 and 18, many of whom faced severe adversity, those who felt they mattered were less likely to have low self-esteem, depression, and suicidal thoughts. Mattering is often a challenge for children in stigmatized groups. LGBTQ youths face high rates of bullying and harassment, and many lack support from adults at home or at school. Lesbian, gay, and bisexual youths are 4 times more likely than their peers to attempt suicide, and a quarter of transgender youths report having tried to kill themselves. Thanks to the Trevor Project, LGBTQ youths have 24/7 access to free counseling by text and phone. Matt Herman, who was a trained volunteer on the Trevor Hotline, emphasized that knowing someone cares, even if it's a stranger, can offer a lifeline. We'd get callers who were 14 and scared, and they just needed to know someone was out there and they weren't alone, he explained. It's cliched, but that's what it was. During the 4 years that Matt answered calls with a warm hello, he often heard the click of a hang-up before callers said a word. Like in the experiment where people knew they could stop blasts of noise by pressing a button, when youths called and hung up, it was as if they were checking to see if the button was working. Over time, many would respond to the comforting voice by finding the courage to start a conversation. "There were so many repeat callers. You become like a friend to them," Matt said. For children, it often takes adults to show them that they matter. A friend of mine's son has struggled with anxiety and depression from an early age. One day at camp, he made a robot. The next morning, he found that bullies had trashed it. A kid said to him, "You're worthless." The message was clear. His work didn't matter, and neither did he. He didn't want to play baseball or interact with other kids at school because he felt like they were making fun of him. He'd put his hoodie on and sit in the back in his own world, his mother told me. A turning point came when one of his former teachers started spending time with him every week. Progress happened little by little as she helped him reach out to other kids and make friends. She offered tips. Join a group that's playing games during lunch. Email classmates and invite them to come over or go to a movie. The teacher then followed up, reinforcing each step he took. She gave him control, but also made it clear that she was looking out for him. She cared. He mattered. When a new kid started at the school, the teacher encouraged them to get together. The two boys connected over a card game, and the friendship took. It was like the sun came out in our house, his mom told me, adding, there's no easy answer. I'm glad we found the combination of things that helped, including medication. But it made such a difference for a teacher to take an interest in him and a friend to bond with him. Mattering was a counterweight to the external bullying and internal anxiety. In Denmark, mattering is part of the school curriculum. During a weekly hour called Klassen time, students come together to discuss problems and help one another. Danish children do this every week from age 6 until they graduate from high school. To sweeten the deal, each week a different student brings cake. When children present their own problems, they feel listened to, and when their classmates seek guidance, they feel they can make a difference. The children learn empathy by hearing others' perspectives and reflecting on how their behavior affects those around them. They are taught to think, how do others feel? And how do my actions make them feel? The fourth belief held by resilient kids is that they have strengths they can rely on and share with others. In some of the poorest areas of India, a resilience program called Girls First has improved the mental and physical health of adolescent girls. In 2009, Girls First started with a pilot project in the state of Bihar, where 95% of women have less than 12 years of education and almost 70% are pregnant by age 18. The program teaches girls to identify and practice different strengths of character, from courage to creativity, justice to kindness, humility to gratitude. Girls who attended just 1 hour a week over 6 months saw their emotional resilience climb. During one session, an eighth grader named Ritu learned that bravery was one of her strengths. Soon afterward, she intervened to stop a boy from harassing her friends, and when her father tried to make her ninth grade sister get married, Ritu spoke up and convinced him to wait. Girls First is run by Steve Leventhal, who emerged unscathed from a serious car accident at the time his wife was expecting their first child. I had one of those near-death experiences you read about, Steve told us. I realized I could die even before my daughter was born, and it changed me. After his daughter's birth, Steve felt so grateful that he wanted to help other children. So he took the reins of Corestone, a struggling nonprofit, and focused on building programs like Girls First. His goal that first year was to help 100 girls in India. 6 years later, the program has helped 50,000. Our work is to turn on a light, Steve reflects. The girls often say that no one had ever told them they had strengths. Helping children identify strengths can be critical after traumatic events. One of Adam's undergraduate students at Wharton, Kayvon Asimani, was 9 years old when his father violently assaulted his mother, leaving her brain dead. Remarkably, Kayvon was able to persevere. Although I lost my mother, Kayvon says, I never lost her faith in me. She had taught her son that he mattered. A friend's father reinforced that belief and helped Kayvon apply to the school that had changed his own life. The Milton Hershey School's mission is to give children the very best education regardless of their financial circumstances. At Hershey, Kayvon had access to great teachers and the opportunity to pursue higher education. The school would pay for any college tuition that financial aid did not cover. teachers helped Kayvon discover and develop his strengths. One encouraged him to start playing the trombone. Music became his salvation, giving him hope that he could